Well, we spend one pair of lockpicks.
12 HP each. Okay.
A fine silken rope. A little bit of dignity. You did have to flirt with them after all.
All right, and now let's go back and tally up.
Live from the Mundangerous Deserted Island in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 309 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about how to run and play survival games. But first, the party checks on the help in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, Judge Dredd is the law in the Character Creation Forge. He's also the bottom half of Sylvester Stallone's face. That's all I know about the character, or remember about the character, I guess.
I thought the world was called 2099 AD, but I think that's actually a Marvel continuity. So it's 2000 AD.
Yes, in the far future. In the year 2000.
Fun fact about 2000 AD is it is always set 122 years in the future. So it started in the 70s, and it is the canon has progressed 50 years. Judge Dredd is now like 80-something years old.
Wait, so it's just a weird coincidence that that's exactly 100 years from now?
No. It's 122 years in the future of whatever year it is. So its current continuity is set in like 2144. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's weird.
It is, yeah. And the continuity progresses 1 year at a time. Like a calendar year on Earth, you know, as the comic book publishes, is a calendar year within the setting.
Huh, okay. Like a season of Friends, I guess.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, except that it lasted 50 years, and now Judge Dredd, who started in his 30s,
so did
in
Friends.
His 80s. Well, right, yeah. That David Schwimmer has not aged well.
But it just won't stop.
Oh, dear. Okay, speaking of It Just Won't Stop, where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
So, the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morningglory campaign. And in Fairhaven, the peaceful capital of Ondaire, the party is hunting down quarry mine seeds. So, the Tharashk Inquisitives, the party sent to investigate the abandoned Temple of the Silver Flame, have returned with no memory of their assignment. The party sends them back out, but this time, they tail them.
They reach the temple grounds in the Marble Hills district, but skirt around it like they don't see the rusted gate just hanging slightly open. Bramble walks up to one of them, gets his attention, and points directly at the temple, but it doesn't seem to hold the man's interest. His eyes just slide away, and he fixates on the other side of the street, as does his companion.
So the party just gives up on the Inquisitives, and they quietly enter the temple themselves. Inside, it looks destroyed and looted. There's dust covering every surface, and it looks like it's been untouched for decades. That alone seems odd to them, since they know that the temple was abandoned 80 years ago during the last war, and it seems impossible that no one would have claimed it for their own in all of that time. But upon very close inspection, they notice just the slightest haze around everything that they see, like a heat shimmer.
So they head up the western bell tower to get a better view. At the top, high above the noise of the street, they can see down into the grassy, unkempt courtyard. They also spy the main steeple of the church and the eastern bell tower.
After a few minutes up there, Lenore, the rogue, notices that the giant bell that they're standing next to is vibrating ever so slightly in the wind. The bell on the other tower, though, as she can see, is not.
Warden then scans the skies for birds and sees their flight patterns are being disturbed by something he can't see. The party surmises that some object, invisible as it is, must be blocking the wind.
So Warden picks up a few loose flagstones and tosses them down into the courtyard. Several of them shatter on the ground, but one ricochets off of something, indeed invisible. And as they peer closely at the space in midair, searching for something hidden that they know must be there, a crack appears in the sky. Its jagged course splits the scene like a lightning bolt, and then it spreads, and the courtyard shatters like glass.
In its place stands the exact same courtyard, but a 200-foot-tall, ovoid monument is now visible. One of the Riadrin Hanbalani Altas.
The illusion is broken, and Vesicott can hear buzzing in his head again.
And we'll find out what happens next. Next week.
So this week, we are talking about survival games. Shane, I am shocked that in 300 episodes, we haven't talked about survival games. Is it because we were avoiding it? Did it feel like a slog? Did it feel like it'd be too much paperwork?
All of those things. I think it's because our general recommendation on survival games is don't do them. So it seemed like a short episode.
Yeah, like RPGs are not the medium for that, right?
Exactly. Not tabletop RPGs, right? Like, and this is where this came in, I think, this time, is because like the video game discourse a week or two ago when we planned this episode was centering around survival mechanics in games and how that works in video games. And it got me thinking about like, oh, there are many core mechanics. Why don't those work in tabletop RPGs?
Mm-hmm. Well, for like the four of our listeners who don't play video games and also me, can you like do a quick summary of the discourse?
So it was, I think it was centering around specifically item durability. So,
as an old Diablo player, I know what you're talking about.
Right. And the central argument was basically item durability adds a survival element to a lot of games that don't need it. And never has there been a game where item durability felt good. And then the counter argument was Zelda Breath of the Wild exists, and I don't know if that's valid or not. But anyway, it just got me thinking about like kind of the broader mechanics that have to interact within a survival game, because on its own, right, item durability, take it or leave it, but when it's one of a series of systems that are degrading your capabilities over time, right, and it's another variable that you have to manage within the video game, like then it starts to add together into a survival game rather than a survival element. And it can work elegantly, it can work poorly. In TTRPGs, it often seems poorly. So we set about, how can we maybe fix that? How can we learn some lessons from video games and maybe set about fixing that in tabletop games?
I mean, obviously, you just emulate the best, most classic survival game of all time, Gauntlet, where where the longer you sit around waiting for something to happen, the sooner you die.
Sure. I think I would use like Valheim as probably my modern touchstone. Games like RimWorld are also kind of fair.
But do those have the existential dread of hearing your heartbeat count down to zero because you couldn't get an apple?
Not quite.
Okay.
That's a Don't Starve, which is actually the first game that our gaming group played together. Like the first video game that we all played together was Don't Starve Together, which is basically like you are transported to a surreal magical world and you have to run around collecting resources, building a base, trying to survive, managing all the systems, killing all the enemies, and you know, generally trying to survive as long as you can.
All right, so to segue a bit from video games then, what RPGs out there right now do survival really well?
So the short answer is Torchbearer. It's a list of one. And the long answer is actually none of them, because even Torchbearer is kind of overbearing sometimes.
Okay, so if you actually want to play a survival game, and like this is a problem in need of a solution, because no matter how many times you tell groups that there probably isn't an ideal way to play a survival game in tabletop RPGs right now, people are still going to want to do it, at least for a short time, right? Like we still do it sometimes. We were like, let's play Dark Sun and there'll be exhaustion mechanics.
Yeah, it was fun for one session.
and we played it for 15.
Yeah, like, and then we overcame the exhaustion mechanics and moved on with our lives, because anyway, so I guess the natural starting place here is sort of what makes a survival genre in video games and how does it work well there? And I think there are kind of two core elements that that lead it off. One is exploration. So there's always that question of what's out there, what feast or folly awaits, what beauty or horror might you behold just beyond the fog of war on the map or just beyond your draw distance, right? Like, what could be out there is always kind of the perpetual question.
And then the thing that I always think about with survival video games, and the thing that sort of sets them apart from RPGs, is all of the subsystems that the computer tracks for you automatically. So whether that is your amount of exhaustion or how much water you've had to drink or how much food you've eaten recently, or like we said before, item durability, the temperature, ambient temperature, the weather, like all of those things, like inventory management, right? Carrying capacity, encumbrance, all of that.
Yeah, and I think those are sort of the two core pillars for the genre. Like, if you don't have those two things, you're probably not playing survival. Everything else you can kind of do well or do poorly, and that's, in my opinion, kind of makes or breaks your game. But to be in the genre, you have to explore, and you have to have systems to manage. And those systems are generally the reason you're exploring, is because you're searching for solutions, right?
All right, but like, what other maybe tentpoles might you find in a survival game?
So I think base building is pretty key. Whether that is like a physical like location, or that is sort of your capability of like constructing on the fly and on the move, right? But the idea that you gain mastery over the elements when you're in your domain, right? So you can create safety for yourself. You can create relief for yourself from the core systems, right? You can get a break. A lot of times, like in some of the best survival games, that also includes like a creative element. I spent hours in Valheim, which is a pretty well received survival game, just collecting resources and building bases, like to make cool Viking towns. it didn't matter. Like, I wasn't trying to accomplish any achievements anymore. I was just having fun building, right? Which is kind of a whole subgenre then. And then I think you mentioned this earlier, inventory management is also a very common theme of survival. So, you know, usually you're having to collect resources in order to refine them so that you can build better equipment, so that you can overcome bigger challenges, right? And it becomes this question of like, how much can you carry? Do you bring armor, or do you bring a bag for extra storage? Do you bring a weapon, or do you bring tools? Like, how many of your item slots or encumbrance points or whatever are you dedicating to your defense versus your convenience versus like the key items you need in order to, you know, move through the world.
And all the ways that you engage with these different subsystems or base building or what have you are basically variations on problem solving. It strikes me that this is in many ways very different from what we might consider more traditional gaming, like first-person shooters and things like that, where it's more about action and movement and reflexes. And this is much more about strategy and maybe a little bit of the grind and some luck.
Because I think the core question is always, how do you overcome this challenge, right? You start out starving. How do you solve that? Now that you're not starving, you're exhausted. How do you solve that? Well, now daylight is fading and it's starting to get cold because it's nighttime. How do you solve for that, right? Like, how do you keep overcoming these problems?
And that leads to the method of advancement in most of these games, right? Like, you start out starving, but you don't stay that way. Well, if you either die or you don't stay that way and you advance.
Yeah, and as you advance, you grow. Like, you gain experience, you grow more powerful, like, your old challenges become trivial, right? Food is just a thing that you've solved by learning to farm, right? But new challenges arise. Like, now there's a new boss that threatens you, or there's a new resource that is riskier for you to acquire that you need to, you know, maybe it's in an area that requires you to have resistance to fire, right? It's, you have to go figure out, how do I get resistance to fire so I can go into the lava lands?
And I think this should be starting to sound very familiar to traditional RPG players, right? Like, there is an element of the success treadmill where, you know, you start at like level zero, level one, or whatever, and you're either going to die and make a new character, or you're going to survive and get better, and then the problems of level one don't affect you anymore.
Yeah, eventually, like, you stop worrying about goblins, right? Like, bandits on the road are no longer a concern for 15th level characters, right? Like, those are a problem for 3rd level characters.
Yeah, or people playing video games when you meet 17th level bandits on the road. Because it scales.
Right. And then I think the last element of survival games that is probably the hardest to design is the tendency for like emergent stories, right? Which is a very core experience of tabletop RPGs, but it's like, you know, what events transpired during this playthrough that made it unique, that made it memorable, right? How do those events connect to each other and share a theme? Like, what mark did you leave on the world as you were going on this survival journey? And I could share an example from Valheim, because we, as a group, played a lot of hours in that. So Valheim is a Viking themed game, right? You're like Viking survivalists. And we had to go collect a bunch of iron from a faraway swamp. Normally you can just teleport once you unlock that technology. But when it's iron, it can't go through the teleporter. So you have to put it on a boat and sail it home. And so...
Right. Nothing dead will go. Yeah, obviously.
Right. So Jim and I get in the boat. Everyone else, having raided the swamp for iron, decides to log off for the night. He and I are like, that's cool. We'll sail it back to town, start it smelting, and then we'll log off. So this is midnight. We're like, oh, it'll take us like 20 minutes to sail it back. It's fine. As we're sailing back, we decide, hey, there's this unexplored part of the map up here. Maybe we should just take like a detour, take the long way home, and just see what's up there so we can get some scouting in on our way. 2 hours, one boat.
Everyone's oar?
And several respawns later, we found that we had taken over an hour detour into some very high level lands that promptly killed us. We then had to get the equipment for a new boat, like get the parts for a new boat, build a boat, sail back out there, collect our stuff off our old crashed boat, collect the pieces of that boat, then sail back home. We went on an odyssey. It took us hours. We log, and then the problem is, on a boat, you can't log off in the middle of it, because there was a glitch in the game at the time. You might not respawn on the boat when you come back into the game. The boat might have moved, and if that happens, you fall in the water and drown.
So, kind of love that.
Yeah, so we were like stuck. We had to get this done before we could go to bed, and that became like Jim and Shane's Odyssey. It was a very fun night. That was completely accidental by going, hey, let's see what happens if we just go north. Like, let's see where that channel leads.
Were your wives still waiting for you when you finished?
Absolutely not.
Not a true odyssey. All right.
No. Well, they were waiting in bed, angry that we were up until 2 o'clock sailing around fake iron through a Viking. Anyway.
All right, so all of these elements are going to be familiar to tabletop players, but why is it that they don't translate?
So you hit on this. All of these systems that you want to manage require bookkeeping, right? Easy to do 10 systems when you have a CPU tracking it for you in real time. Very terrible to do it round by round on a physical character sheet where you have to write it in with a pencil and scratch a bunch of stuff off.
Yeah, I mean, you see this every time that there's like a D&D, for example, video game, right? Like, we did an actual play with Sunless Citadel, and one of our comments about it was, you know, we didn't want it to be like a Baldur's Gate style where you're walking around and playing 4 different characters, because that's too complicated to manage all those sheets, right? Mm-hmm. But like, the video game does that. And I remember playing Neverwinter Nights and being like, oh, there's, you know, 10 people in this server and everyone's casting spells or making attacks or whatever, and like, it's pretty seamless because the computer is just doing all the math for us. But can you imagine doing this at a table? No, I would never do that. It would be miserable. So's most bookkeeping for survival games.
Right, exactly. And then, like, you know, it's one thing to track ammunition. I think that's like the classic example, right? Like, track your food, track your ammunition. When you run out, you're in trouble. But like, when you start talking about exhaustion, you start talking about dehydration, you talk about like these like true survival mechanics where you're expecting a death spiral that degrades your abilities over time. Like, it's not just ticking a box on a sheet anymore. Then it's also understanding, okay, well, I've ticked 3 boxes. What does that mean for these four derivative skills. Like, is that a penalty to damage and lowering my defenses? Is that less health? Is that less health recovery, right? Like, you have to keep track of all that stuff. Like, even if you aren't writing it down, there's a mental load that's associated with that that is just part of the computer's job.
Look, my favorite survival game of all time is, I think, everyone's Oregon Trail. And, you know, in your head, you're tracking five things, is it, right? Oxen, axles, food, medicine, bullets, maybe. That's about it. But, like, mm-hmm. the computer's still doing all of that. I don't need to mark off axles.
Right.
And, like, that is the maximum mental load because, like, the stress of, like, worrying about that stuff and making the gamble about crossing the river or, like, fording the river is the game, right? Like, it is the stress survival.
Also, obviously, Oregon Trail 2, best survival game of all time. Just improved on the original. Just straight improved the original.
You're not playing on an Apple IIe.
Here's my argument. You could use a mouse.
For lazy people.
Hunting was worse, though. I'll say that.
No, you're right.
No skill in hunting in Oregon Trail 2. Another thing that tabletop RPGs struggle with is random failure is a lousy option as a penalty in tabletop games, right? And there's two ways that this happens. One is, like, it invalidates your choice. So, like, you made a sound strategic move, you rolled dice to determine the outcome, and the dice dictated that you were unsuccessful, right? So, like, you spotted the bear, you recognized you want to avoid attracting its attention, so you decide to stealth away from it, but you fail the stealth roll, and now the bear murders the party, right? Classic survival fail, right? Except you did the right thing. You didn't take a risk, and yet you failed, and now that's unsatisfying because you're dead.
So is the issue here that the social contract at an RPG game table usually doesn't involve respawns?
That is definitely part of it. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about that a little bit, but, like, yes, there is very much that element of, like, because you don't respawn in a tabletop game, that's the end of your story, right? And so building a cohesive narrative around that becomes very difficult. There's an expectation that, like, tabletop RPG characters either have a funnel or they survive, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, the survival test cannot hinge on random dice just getting you killed, right? Like, good decisions that produce bad outcomes are doubly unsatisfying when that's the whole game.
Right, like, they're supposed to be people who mean something and do things.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the question of Oregon Trail, right, was not, like, the inter-party dynamics of the four people that are named in the wagon and how these four people overcome, right? Because it isn't a character-driven game. The question is, can you as the player make the right decisions, overcome the random roles, and get to the end, right? Tabletop games aren't about getting to the end. They're about the story that you tell along the way. And so if random roles prevent you from getting to the end when it doesn't really make a ton of sense in the story because it doesn't feel justified to fail, you've got a problem.
And then you also run into death spirals, which we've covered in an entire episode, but most survival games have systems or penalties where as soon as you begin taking a penalty, you now take more penalties, and it, of course, spirals until you die very, very quickly.
Right, and when the name of the game is live, literally, then having increasing penalties that make it harder to succeed at anything just strips you of your agency, right? So now you have less and less impact on the outcomes, and you're just sliding towards death without any control.
That's how I always feel in Zelda games when I take that first bit of damage and now my sword doesn't shoot anymore. I'm just like, I may as well be dead. What's the point?
Why even do this?
Gotta find me a fairy.
And I think there's a difference here, like, again, between media, where in a video game, there's the element of, like, control and skill and, you know, like, there's a at least some element of, like, manual dexterity in most of these games. And so that can overcome the penalty, right? But in a tabletop RPG, you don't get that, right? If your resolution mechanic is dice and your death spiral affects dice, well, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't have agency anymore, right? I'm not playing on hard mode. I'm not playing.
Right. There's no way to leverage skill other than, I mean, there isn't, other than the choices you make. You can't, like, roll the dice better.
Right. Exactly. Then the other piece of this that I think is important is that players don't advance in tabletop games, right? We talk about our characters getting better, but we don't talk about our players getting better. Like, in a survival game, when you die, like, that's usually, like, some sort of setback for a character. You respawn, like, even in hardcore games, like, you know, Don't Starve, like, you die, it's game over, and then you restart from zero on a fresh procedurally generated map, and you try again.
Right, right? You play the game again.
Yeah, you just play the game again, but you get to repeat it. And you, as a player, learn from that experience, right? I failed, but now I get to replay with that knowledge that I've gained. In a tabletop RPG, those rules are laid out for you up front in the book. You have system mastery from the beginning. You might learn a little bit about how they interact, and there might be some, like, you know, theoretical to applied knowledge. But at the end of the day, like, you pretty quickly, like, you have system mastery, you don't grow as a player over time by repeating the same things. Like, the same challenge three times, you don't get better at it.
Right. Except Planescape Torment, and that's literally it. Which, like, I think is basically designed around this premise, you know?
Yeah, it's that's designed to fail and try again, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the whole point of Planescape. And, you know, but that's not a survival game. Right. That's a
right.
It's a
player learning
right
game wrapped in a story.
Right. And so what that means, though, is, like, even if you start the game over again, right, your fourth run, even though you start with the same resources, is always easier than your first run because you know more going in. Right. And that's just the way getting better at games works. Like, you know, that's, like, the whole point of a Souls-like game. Right. Because Elden Ring just came out. The whole point is to go face a boss, die. Go face a boss, die again. Go face a boss, learn his first attack pattern, overcome that, die to a second attack pattern, right? And, like, gradually, like, through repetition, you start to get better at the game and learn how it works, and then you move on. You can't do that in a tabletop RPG. Like, it just, that isn't fun to just keep repeating the same thing.
I mean, yeah, you can, but yeah, it's boring.
Well, yeah, but if your decision isn't changing, right? If you can make the right decision from the first try, then you're not growing as a player, right? You're just doing the same thing and hoping the dice turn out different. Another thing that comes up a lot in TT or in tabletop games is the gritty realism rules, right? Like, the idea that you're injured, so it costs you more downtime to heal, or, like, damage is doubled, or spell slots recover more slowly. And it takes the sense of time to make it more realistic. Boy, do I hate that. Because the urgency is artificial, right? Like, the story goes at the pace of the players. It's a story about the players, right? It takes you the same amount of time to resolve one night of sleep or a week of resting and recuperating at a game table, which is to say, we agree to do that and we stop. So it doesn't really work for survival. All it does is just kind of, like, grind your story to a halt, as, like, you have to wait around for one person.
I hope you saved up a week's worth of food, because I'm still counting that as you sit there and recuperate.
Well, I mean, the alternative is you go out and do stuff. My character is sitting at home doing nothing, and you get to keep playing, you know, game rounds, right? Like, your character gets to do stuff. I'm stuck at home. Why am I at the table? I'll just go make a beer run. Tell me when I get back, let me play again.
Right. I mean, we've talked before about skipping ahead to the action. So mm-hmm. Everybody does that during the rest or recuperate. So all you're going to be doing is skipping different amounts of narrative time.
I think this is improving in some ways, but it's not quite there yet. But base building is never quite satisfying in tabletop games, right? Like, it tends to run in either two camps. One, it's either, like, too mechanical, and so it lacks the creative inspiration and ownership of, like, you know, seeing it come to life and building it yourself, like, you know, taking a pile of Lego bricks and building up a castle. Or it's got too much DM fiat, and the mechanical rewards for it seem too limited to really overinvest in it, right? It just stays too narrative.
All right, so if you're playing tabletop and you're still dead set on playing survival games, what are some ways to do it better?
So this is why Torchbearer is the recommended system and the only recommended system, because it doesn't bother with survival systems. It recognizes that they're just annoying bookkeeping. And so if you need them, you aggregate them. And Torchbearer uses a mechanic called grind. And basically that represents like the more time you spend adventuring, the more difficult it is to keep adventuring, right? And so that's what you manage over time. So you got to reset that grind over time, and that's what you're, you know, focused on. I think that's the best way to do it because it's simple and it's one thing to track and it keeps it narrative.
I like that they lampshaded it, right? Like, oh, what is this? It's grinding. You're grinding. You're just walking around trying to get stuff, trying to level up, trying to make bigger numbers.
Well, I think it's the opposite. I think it's actually, it's grinding you to dust. the act of existing.
I mean, yes, my will to play this game, certainly.
Right.
Yeah, I think every time we come up against how to handle complicated inventory management, for example, in tabletop, the answer always ends up being do it until you don't find it fun anymore, which honestly, for most groups, is going to be a very short amount of time.
Right.
So like you can just get rid of it entirely, or again, you know, play with it for a little while. And then if you still want to play a gritty type of game, you just fade it into the background. Right. Now, mechanically, you stop engaging with that subsystem and don't use it anymore, or you don't count errors or whatever. Your characters in the game can still be counting all that stuff and paying attention to it and going to get the water and building the fires and, you know, maintaining the parapets or whatever they need to do, right? But like that just happens off camera.
You want to quickly get to the point where inventory is more a question of how it's applied than it is a question of what's in it, right? And I think like Blades in the Dark does this really well when it's just, you just choose load, right? And then you figure out what's in your inventory.
And not even ahead of time.
Well, right, yeah. But at the moment where it's important, you choose load and then you decide what's in your inventory later. And then it becomes a question of like, how can I use my inventory most effective, right? That's the problem I'm solving. So like I have a problem. Is there something in my inventory or something that could potentially be in my inventory that will give me a creative solution to this problem? And so like, I mean, an example from our own actual play, right, is like I wanted to harness gust of wind to create a sail. I didn't have a sail, but I did have a tent. So like, you know, in a video game, I probably cannot convert a tent into a sail. There's probably not a mechanic for that. It isn't programmed into the game.
Right. It needs to be something that someone else has already thought of before. You cannot exactly have an original idea and leverage it in a video game.
Exactly. Exactly. In a tabletop RPG, you absolutely can. So lean into that, right? Like give those wins, grant those wins, make that the focus. Is like either you plan and prepare expertly or you use the things in your inventory creatively, and that gets you through your problems. That's how you overcome these survival challenges. And then you can lean on your skills to sort of anticipate what problems that could arise, you know, as you're venturing forth to scale the mountain and find, you know, some gold. What could go wrong on a mountain? What should I bring? What should I plan for? You know, that's what a survival check is for, or a nature check, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like the way that a video game determines what is over the next hill is either it's been pre-programmed and it's always the same, or it's procedurally generated for the most part, right? But in this game, you have an adjudicator who can actually just decide what is going to be over there that will be the most interesting given the party, the party's makeup, who's here at this session today, what your skills are and what you have on hand and what you brought with you and how much you're annoying me right now.
Yeah, exactly. And like that's a man, there is that tendency to just roll on tables, right? Mm-hmm. And like if you just have the perfect set of tables, you can like simulate procedural generation and the world will stand on its own. Like, no, don't do that. Reduce the randomness. Embrace the cause and effect. Like, so, you know, sometimes you just need something to do. You don't know where to go. Like, fine, use a table or pick from a table. That's great. But like, you can just choose the interesting events and then, depending on what happens, apply the next logical outcome, right? So if you go overhunt deer for, you know, multiple months, then there's probably going to be a shortage in winter, right? If you raid goblin villages for supplies, they're probably going to counterattack you, and you're going to deal with that. Like, if you clear cut a forest to set up your camp, then you're going to end up with a bunch of timber. Maybe that's a resource you could trade to it on to a passing caravan. But none of that has to be random, right? Like, all of that can just be, you made a decision. Here's a natural outflow of that decision. Now we've created narrative.
Right. It's also a way to circumvent the death spiral, right? Where you can leverage penalties and then sort of see where the dice land. And from there, you can then adjudicate future penalties, right? You don't always need to apply the same ones all the time. If the players seem like they're having a really bad, boring time, then like lighten it up a little bit. And if they're breezing through it, then make it harder, right? Because you're looking for that sweet spot of feeling like you might die at any moment, but like probably not dying at any given moment, or at least right. Not all of us.
Yeah, I think that's important too, is like you need to give them moments of reprieve, right? When they have a win, when they do get ahead, like let the players have a round of like, cool, we could do the things we want to do, right? We don't have to be obligate survivalists for a hot second. The problems will come back soon enough. And then like conversely, like, hey, if they're getting battered and beaten, like, you know, in a storm, or like winter is just absolutely kicking their ass because they weren't sufficiently prepared, like, you don't need to throw a frost giant attack at them as well. Like, you know, like, it's okay for them to just suffer in the one challenge that they're failing at, you know, and not make it all worse.
Yeah, I think it's useful to sort of go back to some of the like original or like semi-original fiction for survival. Like when you look at all of these subsystems and you look at the challenges that are usually put in front of players, I immediately think of like Robinson Crusoe, you know, like one person alone with nothing. And like what happens at the beginning of the story? Trying to find immediately some shelter, something to wear and something to eat. Right. But like after a while, he's like building rope swings and like, you know, introducing his manservant, you know, right. Like these were not day one problems.
Right. It's like The Martian, you know, like, first of all, pass your suit. Second of all, figure out how to get food. Or like the hatchet, right? It's like,
right,
first
yeah,
of all, survive this plane crash. Second of all, make a fire.
Eat the grubs. Yeah. All right. Eat the grubs. Sure. But like go back to like what makes those interesting and fun, and it's that things were dire and then you overcame them, and then they weren't dire anymore, or they were dire in different ways, or the challenges were different, or you were solving for different problems.
I like that, and I think it's important to note, like, in a lot of these challenges, right, the key resource is actually time, right? It's a question of, if I spend my time doing X, I therefore cannot spend my time doing Y. Right. So I need to prioritize correctly of like, what is my most burning challenge? And you just want to make sure there's enough challenges to go around that, like, there's always a question of, are we prioritizing the right thing? And we roll dice to find out. I do think it's important to think about how you're rolling dice and how you're introducing the randomness of the dice into your game. Because I go back to losing a survival game because of a random dice roll on an outcome from the correct strategy sucks. So
right, when you weren't trying to gamble.
Exactly. So think of it as like, if you are spending resources to secure the outcome, that probably just happens, right? Like, you don't need to roll to find out if like your tent is going to protect you from the elements tonight, right? If you're doing something risky to try and secure a bigger reward, like maybe, for example, instead of pitching a tent, you rough it out, you know, in the cold, well, maybe then you have to roll to find out if something negative happens to you, right? And maybe there's a reason that you would do that, and that's the risk that you're taking. When you acknowledge the risk, then we roll dice to find out. But like, I think it's just important to like give them enough narrative control that like their decisions always have weight. Because otherwise, the dice always have the weight, and the decision is going to be arbitrary if you can just roll your way out of it or roll your way into trouble.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a counterintuitive approach, because when you're playing a survival game, usually people think, oh, this is going to be hard, like quote-unquote hard, whatever that is. Like, it's going to be difficult, the challenges are going to be high, and the chances of survival are, you know, going to be low. But in order to, like, actually pull off that narrative, what you want to do is in some ways make it what we might call easier, or minimize, you know, minimizing the randomness. So, like, if we were playing a heist game and a player said, if we take twice as long to case the joint, can we just succeed without making a stealth roll? I would say, no, of course not. What are you talking about? Like, you're gonna roll, or you're gonna take some sort of risk, because, like, you're in a town and there's, like, guards, and, like, if you go to jail, I don't care, because, like, that's an interesting part of the story, or whatever, right? Like, there's a net in that kind of game, and it's supposed to be heroic and fun and swashbuckling and whatever. In a survival game, though, like, the fiction tells you there's no net, and one failed roll and you die. So you do want to sort of, like, put those guardrails on. If they're like, okay, if I take twice as long to, like, carefully build this shelter, is there no chance that it'll collapse on me and kill me in the middle of the night? And you can be like, yeah, totally, absolutely. You spend twice as long doing it, which means you can't go forage or whatever. But right. Yeah, I can give you that. No problem. If that's where you want to spend your resources.
Exactly. And then the other way to resolve that, right, is, like, you can assume that the players are successful and then roll for the cost, right? So, yes, you definitely are able to build a shelter that is secure and safe and won't fall on you in the middle of the night. Let's roll to see how long it takes you, mm-hmm. right? How much of your time resource are you spending? Or, you know, you definitely succeed at hunting because you have set up camp near a game trail. That was part of why you set camp here. But let's find out how much food you find, or let's find out how many arrows it takes you to secure, you know, food for the day, right? Like, you can introduce the randomness in a way that doesn't invalidate the choice. It just determines the cost.
Yeah, you kind of need to flip the goals here, right? Like, the thing that the players are asking for isn't that we want to succeed at building shelter. It's we want to not spend resources, right? Because that's really the limiting factor.
Right.
Whereas, again, to go back to the heist analogy, it would not be fun to say, hey, no matter what happens, you steal the jewels. But we're rolling to see, like, you know, how many resources you spend in order to steal the jewels.
Right. Well, we spend one pair of lock picks.
Right. 12 HP each. Okay.
A fine silken rope. A little bit of dignity. You did have to flirt with them, after all.
All right, and now let's go back and tally up.
I guess as we kind of wrap this up, right? Like, I think the other sort of way to introduce this is to introduce survival elements, but don't make that the sole focus, right? Like, there aren't games that do this exceptionally well, but you could definitely introduce it as part of an arc or an interlude, or, you know, a framing device, or, you know, some type of flashback story where you can introduce the question of survival, but it doesn't have to become the entire game. And you don't need dozens of mechanics in order to bring it to life the way it works in a video game, because, again, the purpose of a survival video game is ultimately skill, and the purpose of a role-playing game tends to be more about the emergent story and how the, you know, actions of the players impact their characters, right, and how their characters interact and overcome the world, and what they learn and how they change along the way.
Yeah, like, don't play your survival on a desert island minigame. Play characters who got marooned and who need to get off this island.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
That is the sound of a hastily constructed shelter falling on me in the middle of the night, as usual.
I think my coconut telegraph is ringing, so why don't we...
How did we not reference Gilligan's Island? Come on.
Before we answer the coconut telegraph, let's move on to the Character Creation Forge. Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at EvilSansCarne. That's Malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTCast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes.
So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we have Judge Dredd. For research, Shane, did you go watch the movie from the 90s? It feels like it.
I watched the Sylvester Stallone movie in 1995 when I was 9 years old. I watched it in the theater. I think it might have been the first R-rated movie I watched.
I was just going to say, how did you even watch it?
I went with my neighbors who were English. So
it was also the 90s, so like nobody cared.
Different standards. Yeah. Was Highlander rated R?
The original?
Well,
I believe so.
I think it would have been Highlander 2.
Oh, well, that was... No, let's not talk about that movie.
Okay. Well, that might have been my first R-rated movie, but I think that would have been about a similar time. So yes, I saw that. And then I've watched the Carl Urban one, on streaming at some point, but maybe on an airplane.
That makes you a Judge Dredd aficionado. Tell us about the judge.
Okay. Judge Dredd is a street judge in Mega City 1 in the dystopian future of the 2000 AD universe. He, you might note him for his large eagle pauldrons, his helmet that half covers his face, and you can only see his chin because, as you know, justice in a dystopian future is faceless and anonymous.
It's a white dude, though.
I learned from Wikipedia, that's actually interesting. He was meant to be racially ambiguous in the comic because it wasn't printed in color originally. And so the artist actually drew him with like bigger lips so that he would be a little more like he would have, you know, I guess that was,
he could read differently, but then movie casting.
Well, what ended up happening is they didn't actually tell that to all the other artists who worked on the character, and so he over time kind of evolved into just a white dude. Yeah. And then obviously became Sly Stallone, who is
the whitest of dudes. Yeah,
slab of meat. But yeah, so interesting. I think the original artist was Latinx, so like it's kind of an interesting take.
Racially ambiguous futures, that's what's coming.
Right. Notably, he is armed with his pistol, Lawgiver, and his motorcycle, Lawmaster. And he is judge, jury, and executioner. The other thing is Lawgiver has multiple, he could choose multiple types of shots with it. It's like gene-coded to his hand or whatever, so like only he can use it. Only judges can use them, and they have different types of ammunition, and they do fancy things.
Right. Darkwing Duck. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, basically.
All right, so what's the build?
The build is Battlemaster Fighter 13, Oath of Conquest Paladin 7.
I figured Oath of Conquest was going to show up in here.
It just feels right, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does.
So we'll start with Battlemaster. And at first level, you will take the fighting style, Superior Technique. Thank you, Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, for finally letting anyone be a Battlemaster, including Battlemasters. So you can learn a Battlemaster technique for this and gain a D6 superiority die in the process. And then you'll also get Second Wind, which lets you regain hit points as a bonus action. At level 2, you'll get Action Surge. And then, of course, what we're here for at level 3, Battlemaster. You start with Artisan's Tool Proficiency, and then ultimately you will know 8 maneuvers, and you will have 6 total superiority dice, which at level 10 will become D10s. Including the one you get from Superior Technique, which is a D6 until that point. Just a weird quirk of the rules.
Like, that's what we're here for. Weird quirks of the rules.
Right.
All right, so which maneuvers would you pick?
Okay, so let's talk about what Lawgiver can do. So it has 6 types of ammunition. Standard execution, which is just shooting it. Yeah.
Okay.
Heatseeker, which is like... you know, guided missiles or like guided bullets, right? Like heat seeking bullets, also known as hotshot. Strong influence on Rogue Trader and 40K, by the way. So I think that might actually be where the term came from. He also has ricochet bullets, which can literally like bounce off walls and shoot somebody in the back of the head. Incendiary bullets, which are basically napalm rounds. Armor piercing, which is good against armor, golems, robots, that sort of thing. And then high explosive rounds, which really don't need any explanation. So, maneuvers. Heatseeker. We'll get that from Paladin. We'll talk about that in a bit. Ricochet. Precision attack. So that lets you add your superiority die after you see the result. So yes, you did shoot past the target, but you hit a wall and it bounced back to the target. And that still counts.
Intentionally. It was intentional.
Exactly. For incendiary rounds, you will take menacing attack. That lets you add the superiority die to damage, and then force a wisdom save versus frightened. Because obviously napalm, like, it kills you slowly, right? But what it really does is cause you to panic, and that's frightened.
All right, armor piercing?
Paladin smite.
Okay, yep. Checks out.
Might as well keep it coming.
High explosives?
Paladin smite plus trip attack, because that one knocks you on off your feet. that throws the maximum amount of damage, because that's your smite plus you're adding the die from your superiority die, and then you make a strength save or knock the target prone.
I see. Okay, all right. I'm on board. And then let's talk about Heatseeker.
Okay, so Heatseeker, Paladin, Oath of Conquest Paladin gets the Channel Divinity Guided Strike. It gives you plus 10 to an attack. I don't see how that isn't heat-seeking. Mm-hmm. Like, that just seems like too obvious, right? And obviously, like, if you had heat-seeking rounds, like, all over the place, like, you would never not use those. So it must be a limited resource within Lawgiver. And so Channel Divinity, you know, a couple times a day, that, I think that makes sense. Okay, so back to maneuvers. You'll also take Commanding Presence, which lets you add your die roll to an Intimidation or Persuasion check. You'll take Ambush, which, yeah, I mean, obviously, Judge Dredd's not stealthy, but you can add your die to an initiative roll, which, you know, perps never see it coming when he pulls Lawgiver and executes them. Judge, jury, executioner. I mean, what else do you need?
And then you got three more. You have a lot of options. I am actually so happy that relatively recently we've gotten all of these other maneuvers that interact with, like, interface with skill checks, because you don't just have battle masters who are, you know, stuck tripping yet again, or, you know, hoping to miss so that you can use precision attack.
Right. At this point, you want to take the normal good stuff that works with ranged weapons, because obviously you want it to be possible to use with Lawgiver. So Commander Strike lets an ally attack instead of taking one of your attacks. Disarming attack to knock a weapon out of a target's hand. I think that just fits as a judge. Parry, rally, riposte. So, you know, reduce an attack, gain some hit points, or get an ally to gain some hit points, and then make an attack in response.
So as a paladin, he gets Lay on Hands. He gets Divine Sense to, I guess, locate Celestials, Fiends, and Undead who are against the law.
Who need to be judged.
Smites, obviously, and a fighting style. What do you like?
Well, paladin options suck, mostly, yeah. Especially if you intend to wield a pistol named Lawgiver. So we're going to go with defense, gives you plus one to AC. You've got giant pauldrons and a helmet half covering your face. So I feel like that's pretty good defense.
Immunity to disease as well. And then Oath of Conquest gets some really nice spells. Hold Person, Spiritual Weapon. The Channel Divinity forces a Wisdom save versus Frightened for a minute, and then the aforementioned Guided Strike.
Yeah, I like your Channel Divinity, the Wisdom save versus Frightened, just that base ability. Like, that's just shouting, I am the law, right? Like, that is a judge walking in the room, and now everybody scatters, because, like, nobody is innocent in Mega City 1. Like, that's why it's a dystopian future.
It looks like you're making use of a lot of feats.
Yeah, we're going to go for 6 ASIs, which is why we're going to take 12 levels of Battlemaster next. you'll get 2 ASIs from the remainder of Paladin as well, but let's just kind of cover those in total. So the two options here are Crossbow Expert or Gunner. So depending on whether Lawgiver will be a hand crossbow, which is more of a fantasy setting, or Gunner, which is technically available from Tasha's Cauldron of Everything, then you could have an actual firearm. Both of them give you the ability to ignore disadvantage for shooting when you're engaged in melee, and you can ignore the reload property of the respective weapon. Crossbow Expert lets you make an attack with a hand crossbow as a bonus action whenever you make an attack with a one-handed weapon, while Gunner just gives you plus one dex. So either one. Your general move here is going to be using your day stick or your boot knife as your main weapon. Probably going to be a rapier in one hand, and then use Lawgiver in the other.
You did mention a motorcycle, so I'm guessing maybe we take mounted combatant.
Yeah, you take mounted combatant so that you can name your horse Lawmaster and, you know.
And also stay on it.
Stay on it, yeah. Keep it alive. One interesting thing about Lawmaster in canon is that it has advanced AI, so it can think for itself. So, hey, that's a horse. and then after that, you just want to use your ASIs to max your dex and then max your either your con or your charisma.
All right, so you're obviously getting extra attack. You get know your enemy with 1 minute of observation. You get your opponent's combat stats, which is very important for someone who's about to execute someone who may or may not be guilty.
True.
You get
doesn't tell you if they're guilty. Does tell you if you'll kill them.
No, their combat stats say guilty or not guilty. Sure, yeah. Indomitable lets you reroll a failed save, and then at level 11, you get your third extra attack.
Then we'll take 8 levels of paladin, so you'll get an ASI, you'll get an extra attack, which we've already talked about the ASI, obviously the extra attack doesn't stack, but at level 6 in paladin, you get aura of protection that lets you add your charisma saves to allies within 10 feet, so that's just a nice defensive bonus. And then what we're here for at level 7 is aura of conquest, so frightened creatures within 10 feet of you have a speed of 0, and also take 3 psychic damage per turn. We're not really here for the psychic damage, but I do think that's flavorful. What we really like is a speed of 0, because what that lets you do is a sequence of 3 attacks. So whether this is a melee weapon and lawgiver, or this is just 3 attacks with lawgiver, I don't care. First of all, tripping attack. Now they're prone. Second of all, menacing attack with advantage, because they're prone. Now they're feared. Then you walk to within 10 feet of them, or stay where you are if you're in melee, triggering Aura of Conquest. Now their speed is 0. They are effectively grappled prone until the end of your next turn. Nothing they can do allows them to gain movement speed or stand up. So everyone can enjoy advantage against your prone target and just wail on them while they're stuck on the ground.
Right, because in order to stand up, you have to spend half your movement.
Which is zero.
Yep.
Yes. What I like about this, what makes this so insidious, Ishin, is that each step along this journey looks so incremental that none of them could possibly be worth wasting a legendary save, right? It's not until that aura really procs that you realize, oh, I'm up.
Right, when the final piece of the combo kicks in.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the Ixodia comes together and now you've won the game. So I feel like you will trick some DM at some point with this combo. All you have to do is get to level 20 and it's level 19 and it's going to be great.
Except for GMs who listen to this show, you won't get tricked by your level 19 player.
Exactly.
Who's bringing a melee build.
Exactly. And can't fly. All right. Before we wrap up, let's take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every week. And supporters at any level get access to our Plot Hook of the Week bonus content. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about endearing villains.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we're building Carmen Sandiego.
Well, that's it for episode 309 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.